Hello and welcome to another episode of Nuka's Investment Insights. Just a quick reminder that everything you hear is general advice in nature and it's not personal advice. If you do want personal advice, give us a call or jump online and book in a meeting, and we can hook you up with a financial planner. If you like what you hear, hit the like button and the subscribe button. And with no further ado, we'll jump into today. So we're looking once again at China, and in particular in the bear's embrace. And we've had a lot of negative data coming out over the past couple of weeks. And we thought it's well worth a check in just to sort of see what's happening, what's been announced in terms of stimulus measures, and how that sort of all sits. So with that, I'll welcome David Llewellyn Smith, our chief strategist, back in. Hi, Dave. How are you going?
Hi, Daro. Great to be here in a new year.
Yes, happy new year. Happy new year.
Year of the bear.
That's right. That's right. It's not officially Chinese New Year yet. That might be.
What is it supposed to be this year?
It's not sure. Not sure. Right. So I might flick to you, Dave. Maybe we can talk about what's going on within the Chinese market.
Okay, so we're going to do the year of the bear, whether it's actually the year of the bear in China or not. Well, first of all, we're going to kick off with the five D's that are really forming a structural adjustment for Chinese growth. Then we'll have a look at the property crash, which, you know, is truly epic. Look at the policy stimulus and the impossible trinity that's kind of holding the effort to save the economy back. And we'll look at markets fallout and you know, generally ask what next for China, including some geopolitics and other questions that the bear ravaging is throwing up. So without further ado, we'll jump into our five D's of doom, which are pretty well known. Most people refer to three D's, and that is demographics, debt, and deflation, largely harking back to a rerunning of what happened in Japan after 1989. And it's great. You know, emerging growth period ending in a housing bubble and crash, and then, you know, a subsequent two decades of deflation amid declining demographics. And of course, if you know your economics, if you have deflation amid debt or high debt, then you've got weak nominal growth, and it's really hard to pay the debt back. In fact, if you've got deflation, the debt burden can actually rise. So even though you're deleveraging, so it's a very toxic mix.
And to put that in context, you know, so think about it as you borrow $100 and you've got an income of whatever it is, $5. So you pay it off. If you've got lots of inflation, your $100 sort of stays where it is, and your income keeps going up every year. And so therefore, you've got more income to pay back that sort of fixed debt. But if it's the other way around, if your income is shrinking every year, now you've got to take more and more of your income to pay back that debt.
Exactly right. So the demographic story is well known. The little chart we've got here is a dodgy little representation of the working age population in China, which peaked some years ago and is, you know, pretty much into declines now. Now, this matches the Japanese experience pretty closely. And, you know, it comes and basically means, you know, what wasn't called the demographic dividend, that is when you've got lots of young people coming freshly into the workforce and needing houses and houses, new consumer goods, and rising incomes, etc., then that makes high growth really easy. But when your demographics start to decline, all of that goes into reverse, and you end up with increasing numbers of old people that are a burden on a declining taxation take from fewer and fewer workers. And so you actually end up with a demographic headwind, and China is into that.
Just to highlight that as well, it's the one-child policy has meant that, while is it that they're actually going to face the steepest decline, or was this the biggest headwind we've ever seen in any country? So yes. Japan had a demographic issue along similar lines, but China's is just exacerbated by that one-child policy, in that there's just this whole... Yes. And although they've changed the rules now, firstly, you're not seeing the births. But secondly, you got to wait 18 years anyway for those. Even if you did see the births, even if all of a sudden their population, their births suddenly jumped and doubled or tripled, you're 18 years before those people are actually starting to contribute to the economy.
Yeah, and there are no births anyway.
Yeah.
the headline population is now in decline as well, which has kind of shocked everybody, and has happened much sooner than expected by various demographers over the last decade or so. And so it's a real problem. They've tried to fix it with various incentives and have failed. The birth rate keeps falling, and it was hammered in COVID. Various reasons for it. Some of it is natural decline coming out of richer households, cost of housing, too many dudes, all sorts of problems. And it looks irreversible. Yeah. Frankly,
and there's some reasonable analysis out there, I think, that suggests that even the numbers we have are probably overstated by a fair bit.
Yes.
And the reason for that is because local officials were sort of given the nod to say you need to increase your you need to increase the births and need to increase population growth, and so doing what they do best is choices. You could either actually do it and try and put in programs to do it, which they tried to but didn't work, or you can just report that you have, and who's going to know?
So the China's coming into this with a very large debt burden to GDP, 300%. There are, if you count lots of hidden debt, would be even higher. The debt distribution is different in China to a lot of developed countries. Most of it's corporate, or an awful lot of it is corporate. There's a big, decent slice in local governments and a decent slice in households, but the federal government's actually got plenty of scope to expand borrowing, so that's a plus. But overall, it's a very high debt burden, and so if the demographic stuff really starts to have its way, it will be difficult. we're starting to see this manifest in particular in the property market, which is really, in an unruly crash, and has been for the last, I guess, going on 2 years now, with no end in sight. We'll come to the particulars of that in a minute. But that has unleashed a wave of deflation into the broader economy, with weak demand coming out of households who are now deleveraging. They're refusing to borrow, are landing on, excess supply. And so we have the strongest and longest period of deflation, in 20 years we've seen in China.
Just before you get off that second D as well, so the first D is demographic, second one was the debt. It is worth noting as well, even though the size of the debt, you spoke about it being in the governments, is that when you look versus other developed countries, say on the household side, if you compare it to China, to developed countries on the household side, the debt looks manageable and not that high. But if you do compare it to other sort of countries in a similar position in terms of incomes, now it actually starts to look a lot higher within China. Mm-hmm. So there's on some basis you can look at the Chinese debt and say, yeah, look, it's at or similar to some of the worst excesses you can see in the developed markets. But if you compare them to their peers, it's just a light years away from anyone else.
It is, and there are other factors that play there as well. I mean, the lack of a social safety net is a big deal, which in effect makes debt higher than it appears to be, because you have no kind of built-in insurance policy for anything, etc. So anyway, I mean, Chinese households are deleveraged.
Yeah.
They've decided they've got enough debt. They're just refusing to borrow. There's slight growth above nominal GDP, but not much. And as you know, with property still falling at a really good clip, that could continue to get worse.
Then on to back to the deflation, sorry.
And so deflation is very strong, both at the producer level and for the consumer level. It's diminished slightly over the last quarter or so, but it's, you know, looks pretty entrenched for the time being. So I expect that to, you know, continue. I mean, they'll keep throwing stimulus at it.
Yeah.
And we may get these sort of mini cycles where they manage to juice it up a little, but, you know, as a trend, it certainly looks like we're into very low inflation and periods of deflation.
And the, supporting that from the government side is most of the government stimulus has been all on how do we get producers producing more stuff.
And so that
feeds into that, yeah.
So I'll come back to that on the dictatorship one.
Yeah. Sorry, the other one on the deflation side was then, So you add in that, and then you look at the where China sits in terms of other countries now, in terms of production, and it is very hard for it to push through price rises, because when it pushes through price rises now, people are already trying to get stuff out of China. Okay, now we'll send it to Bangladesh, or we'll send it to Mexico, or wherever else, or we'll bring it back to America. So it's difficult to see a path out of that deflationary.
So one of the most important things to note on this, and this is something that the mainstream, even financial press, always ignores, is that having all of this deflation dramatically changes the profile of GDP. So, you know, China's successfully met its 5.2% GDP target last year, but it's a world away from a 5% target, say, in 2019, because back then you had perhaps 8% nominal growth, which is the economy that people actually live in, with 3% inflation, which comes out as a GDP deflator and brings you down to 5%. Now we're doing the opposite, where we have, you know, 3.5% nominal growth, and then real GDP is boosted by a deflator in the GDP calculation that brings the GDP number up from weak nominal growth. But it's the problem is it's nominal growth that matters to paying down the debt. And so it's misleading a lot of people to think that China is stronger than it is. Excuse me. So on top of that, very unfortunate timing for China. We also have this wave of deglobalization coming out of a little bit out of COVID, but probably more out of Russian war on Ukraine and the Sino-Russian alliance, such as it is. You know, this has really got legs now, especially in the US under the Biden administration, and its various fiscal incentives has really driven, you know, a big repatriation of supply chains out of China. Exports are falling to the US at a good clip, and a lot of that is going into, as Damo said, Mexico or Southeast Asia or India, elsewhere, places that are within the US alliance network. So friend-shoring, as we call it.
Yeah. And this is, I guess the thing, there's two parts to this for me, is that one is it's not a fast thing. You build a factory, 5 years ago in China, you're not shutting that factory down to open up a new one in Mexico or whatever, but you're not building a new one. And I think that's where we're really noticing is that the direct foreign investment into China turned negative for the first time in sort of 20 or 30 years in the last 6 months, and looks to be pretty set on that path. And so it's more about saying, okay, well, the next factory comes up, or this factory needs a big refurbishment or whatever. It's like, okay, well, I'll shut it down and now I'll build a new one. And so, so it's going to be a long, gradual process, but just inexorable flowing from,
exactly,
from that.
So, I mean, the US has really led that off. But, you know, there's a lot of building tension with Europe now and China, and there's the likelihood there of similar kind of decoupling or de-risking, I think, especially around cars, because China has been, you know, sort of eating the European car market for breakfast with its lead on EVs. And so I expect Europe to follow the US slowly but surely down the same path. And so if we're using Japan as our Japan post 1989 as an analogy, then this is an extra headwind that Japan didn't really have. Like its currency did fall a decent way as it came apart, and these forces took hold, whereas China, you know, is kind of stuck facing these deglobalization forces as well as everything else. And so it's got this geopolitical problem of what to do about its currency while it's trying to deal with all these internal problems. So this that brings you to our fifth D, which
must actually, sorry, just before we get off the deglobalization as well.
Yeah.
We're in terms of bipartisanship in the US, there's very, very little bipartisanship. China is probably one of the only cases where, you know, even when you're talking, you know, a traditional enemy, Russia, you've got two different, well, certainly a number of different views within different parties, but China is pretty consistent across everyone as to what needs to be done.
Yeah. No, there's no doubt the US is marching at remarkable speed out of the chimerican structure and will continue.
Yes. So demographics, debt, deflation, deglobalization, and the fifth one.
And then the fifth one's the dictator, of course. And so, you know, there's an incredible series of policy challenges for Beijing. And, you know, sadly, it's arrived, you know, right as the dictator has, you know, entrenched his power and, you know, formed a classic kind of information bubble around himself where he's only bought the good news, you know, lest he take your head. And so, you know, Chinese policy efficacy has really declined over the last few years, and it's doing all the wrong things into these problems. And so we'll take a look at what it should be doing versus what it is doing and what the outcome of that will be.
Yeah. And so centralization of a lot of decisions, which when you're a country of 1.4 billion people, means a lot of things just don't happen. And then the other one is that, yeah, from my perspective now, if you're a local official, you're waiting and to be told exactly what to do and when to do it.
Yep.
There's no sort of, okay, I'm reading the tea leaves here that he'd like me to loosen up on property or you know, whatever it is. It's like, no, I'm waiting until it's in black and white and told exactly this is what I'm going to do, and then that's what I'm going to do.
Because... Well, yeah, I mean, Xi's pogroms have disappeared like over 2 million people or something so far. And every time, you know, we're talking very senior people disappearing on a regular basis.
Yeah. Well, and an extraordinary turnover of military staff as well. And so that was the most recent ones was, you know, talk of water instead of rocket fuel and a few things like that, which, yeah, deeper looking, yeah, there's a few big question marks over some of these, but I guess it's the overall fact that, hey, you know, China's been spending a lot of money on defense. Quite possibly there's been a whole bunch of corruption within that. One of the generals, they had literally had dump trucks going to his house to pick up all the stuff he'd stolen as they're driving out to,
funny. Okay, so there's our five Ds. And so what's really preoccupied us for the last couple of years has been the property crash.
Yeah, actually, before we go to property, might just go to a quick message.
We'll be back with the Investment Insights very shortly. Nucleus Wealth is an active and passive investment manager. If you like what you're hearing and want some help with investing, we can do it for you via our active portfolios. Our tactical and core portfolios use the insight.
Dear, almost back. Oh, yeah, back to property crash.
So we'll take a closer look at the property crash, which is, you know, kind of the most critical manifestation of those five Ds at the moment. So, you know, nothing has changed, basically. Prices and sales in China's primary property market, which is the new guilds, are falling. Prices are actually seem to be accelerating to the downside. Sales as well. In the first couple of weeks of January, we're down 40% year on year. And so there's just no end in sight for this. A few brave souls, UBS, try to call the bottom of it, but I just can't see why. There appears to be no investment case for Chinese property anymore. The demographics declining with a capricious dictator telling you one moment to buy and the next moment to sell. Weakening nominal growth, incomes, everything, lousy household formation, massive overbuild, growing glut, falling prices. It's just, there's no reason to buy.
Developer
credibility crash, massive pipeline of unbuilt stuff. It's a mess.
Yeah.
And I was going to say as well, one of the things they did in 2015 was a big focus on rebuilding some of the shanty towns and some of the poor, lower cost housing. And there is some movement towards that. But if you're an existing developer with an existing pipeline, the last thing you want is a whole bunch more apartments, cheap apartments going up nearby.
Well, exactly. And I mean, is that going to incentivize the private investor? I mean, it's just going to crowd out whatever demand is left. So that's a really bad idea. That's part of what we'll come back to is in bad policy. So it starts, which is floor area under construction and now down by nearly 70% from the peak. That is the flow of starts. Interestingly, the stock of starts is only down about 12% from the peak, something like that.
So what you mean by that is the under construction?
Floor area still under construction is down far less. Now, the gap between starts and under construction or flow and stock has to close eventually, but we think that the gap is basically all of these enormous quantity of sold but unbuilt apartments or incomplete apartments right across China. And so the stock is coming down more slowly than the starts because completions are still high, because there's all of this built up, unbuilt stuff. The public support of these smashed developers is helping complete. But over time, 1 + 1 has to equal 2. And the question is, how quickly does the stock catch down to flow? There could be 10 years worth of this pent up failed completions to finish. It could be done more quickly. Access to finance might crash it really fast. But I mean, I've just got just a simple guesstimate on how the two lines have to come together over time. It will probably happen more slowly than the chart I've drawn up, but it has to happen. So, for anything that input into Chinese construction, the future is just grim on this basis. So, as mentioned, households are deleveraging and saving, much more. So there's no end in sight of that on that front. This was 25-30% of the economy as a permanent tailwind, which is now a permanent headwind. Now, that headwind will diminish somewhat over time, but, it's there very strongly now and will be for the next decade. And so you've got, therefore, smash growth in China with no end in sight. They are doing all sorts of things in other areas to stimulate activity to offset this. But, they were always doing that at the same time previously as well. But this was always their one wood, if you like. And whenever they had any trouble, they'd just juice this and off it would run and they'd get back up to 8% growth, no problem at all. But now this is just a permanent decline instead. And it looks beyond saving, way past any tipping point. Which is probably an opportune time to move it to the next segment. And we'll have a look at, what they're doing and why it's failing.
Mm. Yep. So that's up to our policy and the impossible trinity.
Yeah. So typically, you would aim in a circumstance like this, if you accept that you know you're into a debt deflation of sorts, that you know private balance sheets have simply blown themselves up in a bubble of one sort, usually property, can be other things, but when these things are really persistent, it's property. Then, you know, you typically would try to aid the deleveraging process by dropping your interest rates. So you slash them as much as you can. Zero interest rate policy is what, you know, Europe and the US did after the GFC. And that, you know, helps deliver what Ray Dalio calls a beautiful deleveraging, where you're not fighting the outgoing tide. You're actually trying to enable it so that it happens more quickly, and you offset that with lots of fiscal spending, so the economy doesn't tank with it. All right, and so you're going through a process, a simple recessionary process of clearing out the bad debt. And supporting it with government spending. It's not rocket science surgery.
Yeah. So the flip side, though, is, and the Pettus argument is that lower interest rates actually don't really help the Chinese economy, because effectively you've already had lower interest rates for so long for corporates, and because the households have to save, you're actually punishing the households more. So the households who you want to spend by lowering interest rates, you're actually punishing them more on the interest side, and you're helping out these corporates. And so that means, yeah, I mean, the corporates are the ones with the debt problem and the governments, but
like, that's exactly right. It was financial repression of households, and I get that. But I mean, at this stage, what are you going to do? Yeah. Like, you know, instead of perhaps holding interest rates higher for dividends for households, you know, you need to do a reform process that actually shifts income and assets to them yes. from the corporations, right? Now, that's what you should do to boost consumption over a long period of time. Like, that is China's, you know, path to ongoing growth.
Yeah. But Xi has a philosophical...
and political issue with it, I think, as well. He simply doesn't want to hand that power to households. Like, it's... As far as the CCP is concerned, it's better off. The CCP is better off with all that money, those assets, and that power, you know, chained to its corporations, its SOEs. And so it doesn't want to do it and is refusing to do it. But it's also refusing to cut interest rates. So real interest rates are now higher than they were a few years ago, even though we're going through this deleveraging. So they're making it harder for everyone to deleverage and entrenching a debt deflation. Yeah. Now, typically, crashing your interest rates would also crash your currency, which would give you an external boost and, you know, export some of your deflation and boost your boost your activity at home for exporters and reduce your imports, etc. But China's not doing that either. Like, they're holding their currency as strongly as they can and fixing it, because they're afraid of capital outflows from these Chinese savings, possibly crashing their banks. But as a result, they're again entrenching debt deflation, and so instead you're just getting capital outflows from markets, from international investment. Because they're seeing no prospect of growth and all these risks. So,
Actually, just to clarify as well, I think the Pettus argument isn't that you should keep interest rates too high for that basis. But what it's saying is you've got this inherent, is this part about this, one more element of this impossible trinity is when you're trying to get your household sector going, and they're not as indebted as these other sectors, so you want to try and transfer as much to them, but you've got everything going the opposite direction. So all the macroeconomics are going the opposite direction. This is where you need the government to step in and go, right, we need to make sure we're transferring stuff out of the businesses or out of governments and into households. And they have a philosophical argument against that. And you can see that quite clearly in the whole what happened in COVID in terms of most developed countries poured money into JobKeepers and checks for people and all these things like that to keep the economies going, whereas China was all about support for businesses. And so, there's just it's not. I'm not saying there's a different solution. It's just I'm more pointing out that this is just one more thing that they've got stuck, that they've painted themselves into a corner, and now they're trying to work out how they're going to get out of it.
That's right, and their fiscal spending is really ill directed in the same way. So it's all for the supply side. It's all for business. They're printing money to build more apartments, which is just, as we mentioned earlier, more shantytown development, which is just insane. Like, that's insane policy. Like, you've got a massive apartment overbuild. What's your solution as it goes bust? Build more.
Yeah, that's right. We've got and our apartments are too expensive for people to live in. So rather than, and we don't want the prices to fall. So rather than taking the apartments you've already built and letting their prices fall, so poor people can afford them, you're saying, well, let's build more apartments for poor people.
So. I mean, of course, the prices will inevitably fall anyway, even though they're trying not to. So yeah, there's some pretty wacky stuff going on. I mean, they're literally going to print money to build more apartments as public housing into this enormous glut and crash in demand. So what all this adds up to is, the impossible trinity is you can only control two of three variables in macro management out of your currency, interest rates, and capital flows. And China's chosen to control interest rates and currency, but it's lost control of capital flows as a result. And so that's what's happened to its stock market, is you've got foreigners selling hand over fist. That chart in, did I? I did, actually. There's a chart on the next page in the market fallout, which shows you basically, that's the basic story. So this is a pure Japanification now, right? Where debt deflation is going to be entrenched, policy is embedding it, and there's really just no circuit breaker in sight. So we might just tip over into markets fallout at this point, given we're edging that way now anyway. And there is a chart here showing you these massive capital outflows of Chinese stocks. Now, the last few days we've seen, a plunge protection policy where they're going to throw another $250 billion at the stock market, try and stop the falls. These things can work for a month or two. They did it in 2015. It worked for a month or two and then kept falling once it stopped. This one's not even convincing in my mind. They're talking about repatriating money from SOEs, offshore accounts, I guess as a double whammy to support the yuan and to buy their own stocks and stuff. But, I mean, really, I mean, who's going to do it?
Yeah.
How fast? I mean...
And these are meant to be
moving parts, right?
These are meant to be liquidity issues, not solvency issues, so to speak, in terms of saying, okay, I've got a problem in the stock market that people are panicking, but actually fundamentals, they might be worse than they were, but they're still all right. Whereas the issue here is if you've still got worsening fundamentals and you just keep pouring money into it, well, you're just trying to catch the falling knife as opposed to easing liquidity in the system.
Exactly right. So we're in this situation now where, China's embedding a debt deflation because it's not letting its interest rates fall enough. It's not letting its currency fall enough. That has now taken down all kind of equity markets. And I think probably that will keep going until we just flush the whole thing. And it's started to eat away at some of the commodity markets as well. So we've seen the green commodities get smashed, partly on the back of this, not all of them. So, the lithium crash has been, I think, more an intrinsic boom-bust cycle because it's really has been one of the few commodities in a genuine super cycle. But things like nickel, where, various investment banks were claiming there was an immense shortage that was going to last for decades just 2 years ago, it's now in a huge glut because of the Chinese property crash and just not enough consumption of nickel in all sorts of things, including the air conditioners and lots of household goods and things. So you know, that weak Chinese demand has started to eat away at the margin in all sorts of commodity markets. I still think it's inevitable that this takes down steel and iron ore and the coals. We have seen this actually also impact the gas market. Chinese gas demand has been very weak. And thermal coal has come right off. I think there's further for that to fall. Although China's imports of thermal coal were quite high last year, they've just slapped tariffs on everything, so that's coming off. And I think inexorably we're headed towards iron ore here. And go back to that property crash chart, how long it takes for it to unwind will determine, you know, how swiftly steel and iron ore fall, but I think they've got to go as well. And we're stuck in this inexorable bear market for equities. Now, it hasn't really hit Chinese credit as far as I can tell. Outside the property sector, like junk spreads and stuff are okay, and sovereign yields are too high. So there is a sort of ongoing Chinese bond bull market ahead, I think. But it doesn't look like, you know, any of that is a lack of liquidity. It's just because the PBOC has been too stubborn in cutting rates. Now, we saw some more easing yesterday, 50 basis point reserve ratio cut, which, you know, is a little bit more of nothing. And so they're just going to have to start cutting their prime rates, and they'll cut them all year, I think, but more slowly than they should. But the debt deflation will have its way, and they'll have no choice. So
an interesting talk in investment implications, so I'll just go to the sales message first.
We'll be back again shortly. If you like what you're hearing but want a low-cost passive option, Nucleus Wealth is the first to offer passive direct indexing in Australia. The first generation of passive investing was index funds. The next gen was ETFs. Now, direct indexing is here with significantly more customization and control. The benefit of direct indexing is you can add or subtract investment themes, and we have almost 100 different options to choose from. For example, you could buy an international share direct index portfolio that excludes fossil fuels and arms manufacturers and has a tilt towards cybersecurity and cloud computing. Alternatively, you could buy a portfolio with no screens and an extra exposure to nuclear power and defense contractors. You can find out more at nucleuswealth.com. Now back to the show.
Right, so on to implications, Dave.
Yeah, so I mean, the really obvious one is China is going to be very deflationary through this. It's holding its currency as best it can, but there's just going to be oversupply of everything in goods, and so, you know, they're going to get dumped on the world. So we've already started to see that in steel, EVs, as a couple of large headline offerings. I think that's just more and more and more ahead for that. So, I mean, that's good news for those worried about inflation in developed markets, I guess, to the extent that China isn't chopped out of them. global growth headwind for many years. Forget about China as a global growth driver. That's done. A component Chinese growth was of global, and I think it was 30 or 40%. You can at least halve that for the next decade, and maybe more. For Australia, and the timing of this is difficult. If we look at it in 5-year terms, I think you can be pretty confident that you're seeing big falls in the Australian terms of trade. I would have thought it would be sooner, but, you know, any kind of, I think it's an investable time frame. You're going to see big falls in the Australian terms of trade, which means Aussie yield spreads are going to fall as well. So it's an Australian bond bull market as all of these Chinese income flows contract, iron ore being, you know, one of the primary features of that, but much more broadly as well. That's also very negative for the Australian dollar. So, you know, no great shakes for the Aussie dollar over the next few years.
Actually, I've just got a question from a listener, from Dennis. Now, this is more about the short-term effects, I guess, on this. And so he's just questioning the outcome for the Aussie dollar and US dollar and Aussie and US bond prices if the Fed doesn't cut as much as what markets are sort of expecting at the moment. I think the markets are pricing in a March rate cut.
No, the probabilities are tilted away from that now.
Yeah.
It is more likely than March now.
Right. So just his thoughts on if you continue to see that push out, where that leads in the short term for US dollar, Aussie dollar.
For any particular asset or?
Aussie dollar, US dollar and bond prices.
Well, we've already seen the move in bond prices as the probability of a March cut has come down. The Aussie 10's up about 40 points to whatever, 4.3 from 3.9. We're at bottom. There might be a little bit more ahead in that, but I'm not worried about it. I see lots of deflation coming into Australia. Think the endogenous disinflation is really strongly underway as well. I mean, we've been in per capita recession for 18 months. So lots of reasons to think Australian disinflation continues. But in the very short term, yeah, if the Fed doesn't cut, but I think that's mostly priced already. Aussie dollar, I mean, the Aussie dollar is just, absolutely torn in two here between ultimate Fed cuts and a reflation play coming out of a falling US dollar and a just chronically fucked China, if you'll pardon the expression, which, has weighed very, very heavily over on the AUD over the last year or two and still is. And so there's a real failure to launch into a new cycle for the Aussie dollar. I expect that to continue. So I've still got a sort of nominal base case for the Aussie dollar to hit 70 cents later this year, but it's looking more and more difficult with each passing day. It's not a conviction play. And I expect the Aussie to just, act as a Chinese proxy for more or less forever. So it's going to be very difficult for it to rise.
And so just putting that in context, it's a short-term, you can see scenarios where the currency rises with a longer-term view that the Aussie dollar's got to go further down on the back of the trade and China.
My base case is we still rise from here because the Fed will cut and the US dollar will fall. But, the further we get into the Chinese debt deflation, it's just the harder it is for the AUD to get any traction. And there are potential shocks ahead as well, like as this really gets going. Remember, we've only just started this process. With China's nominal growth so poor, the likelihood is that its own income growth will slow for workers. There'll be a lot more unhappy Chinese. I don't know what the dictator will do in these circumstances. I mean, we're already describing a circumstance in which almost inevitably China dumps an enormous quantity of cheap product onto the global market. And so, there's trade tensions coming, renewed trade tensions as a minimum coming on China exporting its way out of this.
And that's just one more argument for the deflation.
That's one more argument for deflation, and that's going to run headlong into the deglobalization trend coming out of developed markets. So it's also more argument for a countervailing policy. That can be quite an unhappy area for the next few years. And ultimately, if Beijing fails, and it is failing at the moment, like it's not doing any of the right things, is going to embed a debt deflation the way it's going, that it may in the end have no political choice other than to try and throw all the angst offshore in some kind of throw of the dice on Taiwan.
Well, yeah. That fits in with a question from Ben about it's about the capital outflows. I was going to save it for that, but you know, that's probably worth bringing forward here is maybe they're seeing the outflows as inevitable because as they need to eye off Taiwan more, that's just going to be the natural consequence.
Rinse and repeat. The more capital flows out, the harder it gets. The more Taiwan becomes a risk, the more capital flows out. I mean, it's a nasty situation. If it did happen that they did something to Taiwan, some form of annexation or blockade or something, it would be such a desperate act that I really think it's the end of the China period and the Chinese Empire as we know it.
We've already reached the end anyway, haven't we?
There's $3 trillion of assets in the US that are instantly be seized. There'd be trade blockades from everyone in all directions. There'd almost instantly be a Chinese famine. It'd be catastrophic stuff. But I mean, this is where, I guess you come into the really hardcore realpolitik of the CCP. Like, they'll do this if they think
it's a choice between the noble Communist Party
it's doom at home or doom abroad. I mean, yeah. And then, you just end up with one of these convulsive retreats from China that it's done time and time again over its history, where it kind of opens up and then contracts into itself again. And I think that there's a certain inevitability to that. The shape and speed of it is probably the only question at this point. So basically, it's not a pretty picture for China, and they're making it worse, not better. I suppose I would conclude by saying, silly Anthony Albanese is doing exactly the opposite of what he should be doing as well. Instead of de-risking this, he's, trying to turn it back on. So, when you're saying capital outflows of this scale from somewhere and this breadth, and your government's telling you to invest, well, you've got a bit of a disconnect there.
Yeah, so that's a good timing for the question of the week. Are we close to the bottom in Chinese growth yet? So, this is for viewers to have their thoughts in the comments. So add in what your thoughts are, whether we're close to the bottom or whether, Dave and I are right that, this is there's a long way to go. So, it's whether some of the what we're hearing from the brokers is that, it's close. But
it's just the wrong question, isn't it? Mm. Like, the right question is how long and how low, not when does it turn?
Yeah. 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 Well, the commodity optimist, I guess, could come up with this thing where China's going to, one last roll of the dice, they're going to throw all this extra money in and try and get the commodity boom going and all these, there's some arguments around this whole, things are so bad, they're going to have to spend all this money just to get things going again. And it's not a zero probability, but it's a pretty low probability. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I would have thought if they were going to do it, they'd do it already. I would have done it already. I mean, it wouldn't make any sense. It would ultimately only make it worse. But that seems to be something they have learned eventually, far too late.
Yep.
That overdoing the stimulus is ultimately self-defeating. Yeah, but
and arguably though as well, they had already reached that by 2019, and they had decided when they put the three red lines on, they decided, right, that's it, we're not going to waste any more capital on property. But then COVID intervened and they're like, well, we've only got one lever to pull, and that lever is more property. And so
maybe they'll release a new strain and
something. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And off we go.
Well, I mean, that's your
Yeah, I was going to say, there's your Taiwanese argument, but actually, if they invade Taiwan, nobody's exporting more iron ore to China to build these apartments anyway. So, yeah.
No.
And they'll probably have something better to do with their people's time at that
point. I mean, there are always, unknown unknowns that could do something, but
yeah.
I mean, the trend is very negative. So, any questions?
No, we've had a couple of, that's just those questions as we went through, sort of covers off on that. So, if they don't have anything else, last call for any questions. But, if you don't have anything else, Dave, thanks a lot for coming along. For anyone who wants to get more from Nucleus Wealth, head to nucleuswealth.com/content. You can see all our posts there. We're on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, pretty much every major and minor podcast platform that's out there, plus on YouTube Live every Thursday at 12:30 if you want to ask any questions. We've got lots of social media, all that's up on screen. And, love to hear from you. And with that, we will see everyone again next week.
Thank you.